proceed to the fifth case, United States versus Johnson. Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Richard McLeish and I represent Thomas Johnson in this case. As Your Honors will recall, this is a criminal appeal that raises an issue under the sentencing guidelines and more specifically concerning the departure authority of a sentencing court. The issue, I think, as with so many appeals, is really an institutional one. It raises the question of who decides what. What we have with the guidelines is sort of a delicate and often somewhat unstable balance of power between the Sentencing Commission on the one hand and sentencing judges on the other hand. And the case law, and more specifically as well, the statute in question, 18 U.S.C. section 3553, makes clear that if the Sentencing Commission has spoken to an issue in the guidelines, if they have addressed it in an adequate way, then you, Mr. or Ms. District Judge, you apply the guidelines as written, but having done so, that's the end of the matter. You cannot then come back to that same issue and use that as a basis for a departure because the Sentencing Commission has spoken as to that issue. On the other hand, if there's an issue that the Sentencing Commission has not addressed adequately, of course, that is something that the sentencing judge may consider. And so the question here, as specifically as possible, is whether the Sentencing Commission, in formulating the relevant conduct provision...
Let's assume we completely agree with you that a departure on this ground would not be authorized.
Yes, Your Honor.
Especially since we now have de novo decision-making authority on this question. Was there a departure in this case? You know, I'm asking you to address the government's alternative ground for affirmance, which is that grouping is required by the guidelines and therefore under the relevant conduct tables, and that just the aggregation list in 2B1.1, the loss to the bank must be considered by the district court.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to that issue, and I realize this was filed belatedly, and I apologize for that, but that is addressed in our reply brief, and the main points I would make as to that are these. First off, the question of whether something constitutes relevant conduct is, as this court has made clear, ultimately a factual one. As Your Honor is well aware, factual questions are questions that are to be...
No, you're not getting the point. The district court construed the trailing clause of 1B1.3A1 is incorporated into 1B1.3A2. That's
yes.
A wholly legal question.
Yes.
Government is asking us to disapprove that.
Yes, I understand that.
As a matter of law, and therefore to say that this is all, that these offenses are grouped and it's all relevant conduct. That's the question I'm asking you to pursue, and it has nothing to do with the facts of this case.
Well, Your Honor, I submit that it does have to do with the facts of this case, because what you need in order...
Whether the trailing clause of one...
No, I'm not addressing that. You're not allowing me to finish my thought.
That's what I want you to address.
Well, yes, the trailing clause raises a legal question, and I agree with you on that.
Yes,
the question has
to address that question.
Well, if you take that out, then the question is whether the conduct in question constituted relevant conduct, assuming that the judge erred in making that decision on the trailing clause. That raises factual questions under the guidelines, specifically whether that conduct constituted the same course of conduct or common scheme or plan as...
Let me try once more. Are you defending the district court's legal decision, or are you not?
Your Honor, as I indicated in the reply brief, this ground was not one that we raised below. Certainly, if I could formulate a persuasive argument in favor of that particular construction, which was not raised, I would have done so, and I have not.
So the answer is no.
Yes, Your Honor. And what I'm asking for is if the court should decide that the district judge erred in that regard, and I'm sorry, I thought that was where you were heading in this as to what happens then, I submit that the appropriate step for this court to take is not to, as the government suggests, try to resolve that issue on its own, namely whether this other conduct constituted relevant conduct for these purposes, but rather to remand the case for further findings with respect to this highly fact-intensive issue. And that, I'm sorry, was the apparent misunderstanding that I had with regard to your question.
Thank you.
Could I ask
you something, please?
Yes.
Could the district court consider Johnson's participation in the bank fraud as part of his background or character rather than considering the conduct itself and make an upward departure accordingly pursuant to 1B1.4 of the guidelines?
Well, Your Honor, in terms of background or... Well, I'll respond to that in two ways. One, in terms of background, what you're talking about here is other criminal conduct, allegedly, according to the government. The government did seek an upward departure here on the ground that Johnson's criminal history did not adequately reflect that, and the court specifically rejected that. Having rejected that, and having found that this did not constitute relevant conduct, it seems to me, then, that this was not a proper basis for an upward departure because the grounds under which it could conceivably be analyzed had already been thoroughly and adequately explored by the Sentencing Commission. I think that, Your Honor, if you were going to take that road and say, yes, this is an appropriate departure, I think that would create a great deal of havoc, particularly with respect to the...
Probably no more havoc than we usually create.
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, but the havoc that this would create, I think, would really go at the one of the fundamental purposes of the guidelines, which is reasonable consistency in sentencing. Let's say you have a drug case, and you have offensive conviction, X amount of drugs, then the government tries to bring in some other conspiracy that they say includes other drugs. The district judge rejects that as relevant conduct under the specific facts of the case. And let's say you have two cases that involve similar facts in front of two different judges. One judge, if you embrace the sort of departure here, might say, well, you know, I think, maybe it's not relevant conduct, but I think it sort of reflects poorly on the guy's background, the guy's propensity to commit further crimes, and he needs a little bit more special deterrence, and so I'm going to depart upward on that ground. The other judge thinks, well, you know, the guidelines as well as the statutory framework is already so severe with regard to drug crimes that I'm just going to stay put within the guidelines range and not go outside of it. And what you would have if you accept a departure theory on this sort of nebulous ground pertaining to a person's background, if you would have similarly situated defendants who had similar relevant conduct issues raised and similarly rejected, you would have them treated differently because of the particular judge's perspective on the sentencing laws as they relate to drug offenses. And so I think that it would really undermine the fundamental goal of reasonable consistency in sentencing.
You know, as you know, the standard review with which we review the application of the sentencing guidelines, you know, was changed with this new Exploitation Children Act. And the government says that the new standard of review doesn't fundamentally alter our analysis. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do agree with that. Just one other point, Your Honor, in terms of departing on that sort of ground. I think that what happens then, if you permit that sort of departure, is it in effect gives incentives for the government to do the type of thing that was done here. Namely, charge somebody with a relatively small crime and use that as the gateway to the courts to then try to obtain a sentencing range that doubles or triples the guidelines range. And as a matter of policy, it seems to me that a construction of the judge's departure authority ought not to be promoted that in effect promotes that kind of prosecutorial conduct. I see that my time is up, and unless you guys have any further questions, I'll wait to see whether you indulge me with a bit of rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. McLean. New time.
May it please the court. Johnson's sentence properly accounts for the seriousness of his conduct. It should be affirmed. The district court found at sentencing that connected to the conspiracy to obtain fraudulent Social Security cards, Johnson was, quote, involved up to his eyeballs in a connected scheme to obtain money fraudulently from banks. The district court took this behavior into account in a 10-level upward departure. In doing so, it relied on an appropriate, indeed an encouraged basis for departure. Alternatively, the relevant conduct provision, when properly applied, would bring Johnson to the identical sentencing range. Either basis provides an appropriate one for affirming the district court's sentence.
I'm kind of, you know, doesn't it seem likely that the sentencing guidelines may, in fact, have adequately taken into account the harm that's caused by producing and transferring these false Social Security cards? Because what else would, and you can help me, what else would one do with false Social Security cards other than commit financial crimes?
The financial crimes would certainly be one. False identification would also perhaps allow people to come illegally into this country. That would be a different kind of crime. They would also allow minors to purchase liquor, I suppose. So I think there is a range of things that they could be used for. In this case, the district court found that it was clear.
Security cards?
It led to then obtaining identification, which in this case it did, a state identification card. Perhaps that's a stretch, but I do...
When you go to the local 7-Eleven and it says, we card, if you show them your Social Security card, will they give you a six-pack of beer?
Fair enough. I was trying to find situations where the Social Security card would be the predicate to engage to creating a false identity.
Well, the table at the end of the guidelines links Social Security card fraud to two basic guidelines. One is the illegal immigration guideline, which is obviously not entailed here.
Yeah.
And the other is the fraud guideline, 2B1.1.
Right.
Now, one can have a dispute here about how the sentence is correctly calculated using 2B1.1. But if you correctly calculate what the size of the fraud is under the 2B1.1 approach, when, if ever, would it then be appropriate for the district judge to say, well, the table and relevant conduct rules just didn't sweep in enough. I want to pull in more. That sounds like it would be disagreement with the way the guidelines calculate relevant conduct.
Right, and it would have to be an unusual case, a case that was outside of the heartland of cases. So we believe...
That's just jargon. What do you mean by that?
Okay, I'd like to be more specific. If you go to the application notes that accompany with 2F1.1, that was the applicable sentencing guideline at the time for fraud, it says if the actual loss does not account for the seriousness of the defendant's conduct, this is an appropriate basis for a departure. So it's an encouraged basis in that sense for departure that the Sentencing Commission is telling you we have done what we could.
Well, I read something like that. I read it to say conduct of which he was convicted, not every bad thing he's ever done in his life. Right? If it didn't account for the fact that he had also committed a murder and engaged in drunk driving and so on, that's not a ground for departure. The thing that actually struck me when I first read the district court's opinion was the district court seemed to think that the guidelines either called for or authorized real offense sentencing. And it was a specific decision of the Sentencing Commission to reject real offense sentencing, to have charge offense sentencing with the relevant conduct tables picking up some elements of the real offense. And a district judge who says, I believe in real offense sentencing, the Sentencing Commission didn't, so I'm departing, seems to me is just fundamentally at odds with the guidelines. It's not a good reason for departing.
And we don't suggest that would be a great reason to depart. In this case, that wasn't what happened.
It's not really not a great reason to depart. It's an illegal reason to depart.
Your Honor, what I'd like to get to is we do believe, and we have argued alternatively, that this falls within the relevant conduct provision, that this is in the kind of behavior that the Sentencing Commission deemed relevant for sentencing purposes and to arrive at the actual sentencing range.
So are you aware of any other case in which a judge made a determination that some particular conduct was not relevant conduct for purposes of determining a sentencing range under the guidelines, yet at the same time use that conduct to make an upward departure?
Your Honor, we've cited cases that say that that is allowed, including cases from this circuit, on page 20 to 21 of our brief. And in those cases...
Of course, the question is no longer whether it's allowed, but whether we like it.
And one of those cases is...
The Department of Justice is the entity that talked Congress into making our review de novo. Here we are.
And that's true, Your Honor. One of the cases is from the circuit, United States versus Dawson, and in the remand, the instruction that the circuit court gave to the district court was this conduct, it was a bank robbery case, so it did not fall within A2, was not a groupable offense. This conduct might be considered for a 5K2.0 departure, but you would have to show it's connected. And that's what the Seventh Circuit required as it was remanding the case back to the district court. We've also cited cases, the United States versus Kim out of the Second Circuit was one of the first cases to look at this and say, although it doesn't fit the technical strictures of the relevant conduct provision, it can still serve as a basis for departure under 5K2.0 if it is connected to the offense of conviction. And in that case, you had immigration offenses. The offense of conviction was bringing people into the country. At the same time, the defendant was carrying counterfeit money. The Second Circuit remanded to see if there was a sufficient connection there, acknowledging that it didn't qualify as relevant conduct under the guidelines, but that it could qualify as a basis for an upward departure. We do believe that this behavior fits very well within the relevant conduct provision A2. As this court has noted, they are groupable offenses. The district court gave us very explicit factual findings. And from those factual findings, this court knows that Johnson was directly involved, his participation was direct in this bank fraud. The district court told us that Johnson procured the Social Security cards. The district court tells us that it's Johnson's contact at the Secretary of State's office that allows his associates, Harris and Burks, to go and obtain her false identification, state ID. The district court finds, as a factual finding uncontested here, that Johnson has in his apartment the Dr. Cook County Vital Statistics form that both Harris and Burks use when they're opening these bank accounts.
Was any of that the basis of the indictment? That's really, I guess, you know, the bottom line question.
The basis of the indictment was the Social Security fraud. And this now is a question about related conduct and whether or not this would come into the relevant conduct provision.
I'm sorry. Couldn't he have been indicted for all of that as well?
Yes, Your Honor. And then
warned?
That's the prosecutorial charging decision. That's not in the record before this court. And the relevant conduct provision has been applied to include offenses that are not charged or even acquitted or even couldn't have been charged because of a statute of limitation problem.
Don't I know?
So we believe it is appropriate to look at what the district court found here, and his factual findings do support the finding of relevant conduct in this case. Moving then from his direct involvement to the requirements of a common scheme or plan, the sentencing guidelines indicate you're looking for a substantial connection between the two schemes.
Philosophically, because he seemed like such a nice person, do you think this is fair?
Yes, absolutely. This is with respect to Johnson's conduct in this case, Johnson's conduct, the district court found, was clear. Not only did he participate in the Social Security card fraud, but his participation in the bank fraud, the district court said, was deep. He had a deep involvement in that bank fraud, and he was involved up to his eyeballs.
See, that's my point. It was deep, it seems. He's up to his eyeballs, it seems. Why not indict him for that?
And again, that goes back to the charging decision, which has a myriad
of
considerations,
right?
Behind it.
You can say that. You can say that. You know, I mean, that's what drives it. You're the executive branch.
Right. It is.
It's not rude to say that we can't get into the charging.
And certainly, by the fact it's not in the record, it's not before this court what those reasons were. I would say that when this court has addressed the concern over charging decisions, it's addressed it in the context of whether or not the evidence that sentencing is based on is sufficiently reliable. In this case, there's been no challenge to the evidentiary findings, the district court's factual findings. Moreover, the departure in this case of 47 months is much less than this court has approved of in other cases, where it's approved of departures that go from 40 months to 40 years, or similarly large departures. We would just note, also under the relevant conduct guideline, not only do we know we would be in the same sentencing range, but we have certainty of where the district court would arrive in that range, based on what the district court said in sentencing in this case. Drawing the court's attention to Appendix 39 and page 39 and 40, the district court said he sentenced Johnson to the middle of the range because all other things being accounted for, the seriousness of his conduct and his criminal history, he viewed the middle of the range as the default. In United States versus Benitez, cited in our brief at page 32, note 16, this court used the exact same analysis to affirm a sentence by the district court. We would ask this court to affirm Johnson's sentence.
All right, thank you, Simon. Mr. McLeod.
Your Honor.
2 points, one directed to each of the government's arguments. With respect to their first argument, that the case law authorizes consideration of conduct that has been rejected for relevant conduct purposes for a departure, the government has not cited a single case, and I submit it's because there aren't any, that involve an offense of this type, namely an offense involving a fungible harm, such as drugs or money, in which a sentencing court has rejected the conduct for relevant conduct purposes, but then come back and said, I'm going to consider it anyway for departure purposes. So no matter what they may have in terms of case law or general language that seems to sweep quite broadly, there's not a single case that they have that supports a departure in this context, which is, as the guidelines make clear, a unique exception to the general rule.
Let's just say this case were to be remanded.
Yes.
Could Mr. Johnson come out in worse shape?
I'm pausing because that raises a number of different concerns, legal, tactical, and so forth. It is my understanding of the law that a sentencing judge is allowed to take a fresh look at the issues so long as there's not vindictiveness. However, that is cabined by the fact that the issues that may be addressed are limited to those pursuant to the remand. So whether the question is, could the judge on remand decide, I'm going to get to the same route as on relevant conduct grounds, but now I've decided for whatever reason that I'm going to put you to the high end rather than the middle end. Yes, I think that that is perhaps a possibility, absent vindictiveness. However, and this gets to the point that I think, and maybe there's no quarrel about this, though the government seems to have quarreled, I think that a remand would be essential here because the nature of the factual findings, or what the government calls factual findings here, is the judge's up-to-the-eyeballs comment, and that is that's language that I can't challenge, that you can't review. I mean, what am I supposed to say? No, it's up to his knees? Plus, the other problem with that is that it's not even...
Your point would be that the table in 2B1.1 does not use eyeballs as the denominator. It uses dollars.
Yes, Your Honor. And relating to that, the problem is that that's not even the relevant question. The question is not whether somebody is involved in two different things. The question is whether, as a matter of factual sub-issues, those two different things are sufficiently linked in terms of commonality of victims, commonality of modus operandi, and so forth, so as to make it relevant conduct. And that is a question that the judge never resolved, never really addressed, much less make specific findings on.
He made that global comment about the eyeballs, so I guess...
The eyeballs point...
He got into that he made some assessment of connection.
I think that's not so much a connection as it is the eyeballs comment, I think, is an assessment of culpability for both. And he does say at one point that there is a connection. The problem with that is that the relevant conduct doesn't just require some sort of connection. It's a very specific term of art that requires specific factual findings that were not made here, and that, as far as we know, were not addressed properly here. And so for that reason, I submit that if Your Honors reject the district judge's legal construction of the relevant conduct provision, the only appropriate action to take here would be to remand it for the kinds of factual findings that are necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Lee, I have a thank the court
for accepting this appointment and ably representing Mr. Johnson, but if you could focus a little bit more on the timing of this issue.
Yes,
I appreciate that. Court would appreciate that.
I understand. Thank you.
All right. Court will stand. Case taken under advisement. Court will stand in recess.